This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Forever Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning a winning inside fix, how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and onomatopoeia. It's comic book commentary.
All right. Well, my name is Brian Hill, and I'm recording a audio kind of, I guess, walkthrough of Batman and the Outsiders number 8. So the issue starts on page 1. You know, we've got the crisis in motion with the plane headed towards Gotham. What I really wanted to do here was, you know, kind of echo the, you know, the kind of classic aspects of the character. You know, the idea that Batman is almost like a force of nature that Gotham can call on to stop something. And, you know, we go to page 2, and we see him here, you know, looking at the bat symbol, thinking about the things Batman thinks about, the things he's failed, the people he's left behind. You know, I think a big part of Batman as a character was that he's always taking on the weight and the responsibility of tragedy. Even if it's not his fault, he makes it his fault. And I've always admired that. I mean, it's not necessarily the most positive thing to do, but there is a nobility in it. And that's part of why the character means so much to me, and I wanted to echo that. You know, a lot of times in comics, I feel like the superheroes, they're not saving people enough. You know, it descends into soap opera, grudge matches, but we get left behind in those stories. And for Batman and the Outsiders, I didn't want the story to feel like it was happening indifferent to us, to suffering, to protecting the innocent. The next page, we go into the middle of this kind of tension-filled action sequence here. We've got Caliber, who has revealed he is now working for Ra's al Ghul. Does the idea of a contained space action sequence with these characters is interesting to me because it maintains a different kind of tension. You can't go all out with your powers because you are in an environment that can't sustain that kind of battle. And it, you know, it just adds a different dynamic. When you're doing action, what I always try to think about is how can I add a layer to this, something that makes it a little more than just punch face. You know, whether it's in the blocking, the location, the characterization that's being revealed. In this case, we have Sophia, who is wrestling with her Babylon persona given to her by Ra's al Ghul. And if we go into the third page, you know, she makes a choice to spare the heroes from Caliber's treachery. Which sends us into a big death spiral. One of the great things in comics is whether it's two people talking at a table or it's a plane about to crash into Gotham, it costs just about the same, right? Like there's a, you know, kind of equivalence of spend. So you can make it big. You know, comics can get really big and then suddenly kind of small and intimate. It's unique to the form. You know, I work in screenwriting and television writing where budget is always a consideration, and it's nice to be able to work in a form where you don't really have to think about budget. You can do anything you want. So the next page here, page 5, you know, we have Jefferson and Tatsu struggling in the falling plane. And a lot of people think that I'm setting up a potential romance between the two. And that's not necessarily what's on my mind. I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm just, I don't think about things in that way. You know, if you're going to do a love story between characters, I think it has to evolve organically, kind of out of their relationship. And some of it's reader response, and some of it's what you see potentially for them. And the question for me is always, does the relationships, does it allow us to learn anything more about these characters? Is it just a pairing, or is there something unique that could get unearthed about each character in a relationship that wouldn't be able to be accessed otherwise, right? I mean, it's, again, story is the master of all of this stuff. So it's never really about what I want to see as much as an opportunity that presents itself. And so I don't know where the relationship is going to go. But I'm having a lot of fun writing it. So now, we go to the big splash page here on page 6. And Dexter is just a brilliant aesthetic storyteller. He's able to create these huge moments that are so powerful in like a really graphic way. And I'm learning more and more how to lean into it. So one of the things that happens when you're working on these things is it takes me a few issues before I really start to get a sense of the way the art is collaborating with the writing. And over time, you get more comfortable, and it's almost like basketball, where you can not look at, you know, where you're throwing the pass and just know that the ball is going to get there. And it takes time on the court to develop that relationship. And Dexter and I think we're getting there, you know, and it's really me, you know, the onus is on me to have to respond and be better, be a better, I guess, vehicle for his talent, which I think is kind of the job of a comic book writer in a way, is you want to vehicle the collaborators you work with. You know, right? The script starts the process, so you have that opportunity to do so. And then we are on the next page here, and you know, we go from kind of like a violent image on page 6 to a beautiful image on page 7. And you know, I love juxtaposition. You know, I love going from violence to beauty, going from serenity to chaos. All of that makes the page flip experience for the reader a little better. Now down here, yeah, sometimes if you're looking at page 8, my filmmaking instincts show up sometimes. I try to keep it in check as much as I can because comics is a different form than movies are. But sometimes you almost treat the reader's eyes like a camera. And when you want to slow time down, you pick a composition and you kind of hold it and show in little ways, you know, what's happening in the progression of time. And it does give things a cinematic quality here. You know, you've got even panel size for the first 4 panels, and the 5th panel is a little bigger. We get to our close-up. And that's like editing and pacing. So I don't have native comic book instincts. All of my editing instincts come from filmmaking. You know, I think about when would I cut to a close-up? When would I use a long shot? So the next page, you know, is not a splash page because we just have a panel here at the top and then 3 panels underneath. But it almost serves the same purpose as a splash page. And I love the way Dexter draws Batman. You know, he just gives Batman like a strength and a just such a strong, forceful quality. You can almost hear, you know, the Kevin Conroy, you know, "And he'll never have it," or "You, Sophia, welcome to Gotham City." Like, you can sort of hear that there, and you know, that's great. And then, you know, we have Jefferson and Tatsu, Katana. Kind of in a little moment of lull after almost dying in a plane crash. I love these little moments of consequence and recovery between these heroes. that little beat that makes them human right after doing something superhuman. Again, I guess that's that juxtaposition that I'm always chasing. So now we have the next page here, Jefferson and Bruce talking about Alfred's death. You know, Alfred dying, you know, really kind of forced me to wrestle with that in a way that I didn't know I would be going into writing this book. But you want all the Bat books to at least be in the same emotional continuity. You know, I don't know. I can't tell you, well, Batman is happening on Thursday and Batman the Outsider is happening on Friday. I don't know about that. But you want the bigger moments to speak to each of the books, I think, in a way. So I had to incorporate that there. And the friendship between Bruce and Jefferson is something I'm really enjoying evolving and developing. You know, Bruce needs friends. And in a way, I think Jefferson also needs friends. I have never looked at the relationship between them as, you know, Jefferson is serving Bruce Wayne, or, you know, he's an errand boy to the Batman, or any of that. No, I think they're just two very different people that have different ways and you know, different modalities of dealing with the world. And Bruce brought Jefferson into his world because he admired what the man is. And Jefferson admires many things about Bruce Wayne as well. But Jefferson doesn't necessarily admire things about Batman, if that makes sense. Right? So he is always talking to Bruce, even when Bruce is wearing the cowl, and forcing that truth, you know, between them. And I think that's something that's helping to strengthen their relationship. And I think it kind of helps each of them to be in the presence of one another, even through difficult times. You know, moving on from page 11, you know, we're going to page 12, and now, you know, Sophia is being brought to the Batcave by Katana. I'm very reluctant to just have anyone know that Bruce Wayne is Batman. And in this issue, I make it pretty clear that Sophia doesn't know who Batman is. Tatsu, Katana, she may, but Sophia doesn't. You know, and you want to preserve the majesty of the Batcave. You don't want him to become too colloquial, too, you know, I guess, approachable. You want to maintain awe, I think, with Batman. And you know, with Bruce, you can do certain things. But when a character is brought to Batman's world, you know, his cave for the first time, I think it's a moment that requires some kind of, you know, awe-like bit. And so if you look at page 12 with this big, beautiful panel that Dexter drew and the different Batmobiles, you know, that are there. I think it helps evoke that feeling of being introduced to the cave for the first time. You can almost hear like the Danny Elfman in the background. Like that's the kind of stuff that I love doing. It's what kind of keeps me working in the media and being able to recreate those moments. You know, and they're having the conversation about the nature of Batman, which is kind of what happens in books. That are group books where Batman's a part of it. You're sort of, you know, expected, and it's fun to do these conversations where people have discussions about the nature of Batman. He's a character that people often talk about more than they talk to. I find that interesting to write because it allows you to paint him in different colors depending on who is speaking and what their perspective is. You know, and then we have Sophia and Katana, you know, sharing this moment here. I don't often think about making sure that, you know, there's enough representation for the black characters or the female characters or the gay characters or the straight characters or what have you. I don't have those prejudices in my heart or my mind, right? So it's not something that I feel like I have to kind of work towards. I just try to make sure they all happen organically. You know, in writing, there's a thing called the Bechdel test. And I guess this might fail the Bechdel test in the sense that they are having a conversation, but they are having it something about Batman. But I guess they're really also talking about her, right? So if you go to, like, page 14, we have this 9-panel grid, and Dexter is able to give you so much information in a 9-panel grid. You know, 9-panel grids can be difficult because they can wind up just being a bunch of big heads if you're not careful. But Dexter is very good at picking angles and being able to add detail and a sense of space. You know, he knows when to drop a background out, knows when to put a background in. It's never something that I have to talk to him about. He just does it instinctively. And now they're having a conversation about Sophia. You know, Sophia and Katana are talking about her. So I guess this page passes the Bechdel test in a way. Now, for those who are listening who don't know what the Bechdel test is, it's a test that asks a question. Does your story have a scene where two women have a conversation, a moment that isn't about a man? And it's a good thing to keep in mind, I suppose. But yeah, you know, it's hard to have a bullet point list of things that you're trying to, you know, make sure you accomplish. But it's one of those things I look at after I've written a draft, and then I can go back over it and see if there's a way I can make it more inclusive or a way I can make it, you know, make sure everyone has a voice and no one feels left behind. But I always make sure that it's governed by story. You know, story has to be king. And whether it's a female character or a male character, a black character, a white character, a Latina character, you know, what have you. I make sure that they can all have the same range of characterization. You know, I mean, they can do horrible things. They can do honorable things. They can get hurt. They can suffer. And I don't try to protect any of my characters because I think that hurts storytelling to have to do that kind of thing. And readers are very smart, and readers understand nuance. And as long as you're thoughtful about your work, I think that they will take that trip with you, and they will trust you that you're not going to overlook, you know, a certain demographic in the way that you execute your story. So moving on to page 15 now. Now we get Duke and Cassandra, you know, and so because I have so many characters in Batman and the Outsiders, I tend to pair them off. Not always the same pairs, but I do tend to break them into two-person scenes. Mainly because I feel like scenes with two people in them are a little more rich. You can do a little bit more in-depth work on them. So it allows me to explore their characterization in an interesting way. So we have Duke here using his, you know, his new powers, spreading the darkness, controlling the darkness, powers given to him by Ishmael, who's changed him, metahuman to metahuman. So we're building that plot point here, and we're leading it, you know, into the next series of issues, which is going to be a big part of the story going forward, is what's happening with Duke and his relationship with Cassandra, how their friendship is, you know, kind of helping both of them. Previous to this, Cassandra dealt with the return of her mother, Lady Shiva, and Duke is now dealing with how he's been altered by his enemy, but he also feels somewhat empowered by it. So, you know, it's, again, it's one of those things where I try to keep things from being too predictable and keep people from feeling like they know, you know, where things are going to go. So this is the beginning of a long journey for Duke and Cassandra Cain. But I like their trust. You know, I like the fact that they do care about one another, and it's a real friendship. You know, again, like, I don't have romance on the mind here. I don't think that friendships have to always turn into romance. And so I feel like Duke and Cassandra are more brother and sister than anything else. But it doesn't mean there can't be a tenderness and an intimacy between them. It just doesn't have to be colored by like romance. Not in this case. Moving on from page 16, now we're on page, you know, 17. And it's Jefferson sort of checking back in with this old world. I mean, there's been some discussion about Jefferson and his work with Bruce Wayne and, you know, has he forgotten about being a school teacher? Has he forgotten about, well, the world he left behind? And in Batman and the Outsiders, I have him working in Metropolis as a school teacher instead of Cleveland, which is a city he's normally associated with. Cleveland is still in his background, but I have him as a principal in Metropolis. And that's really just because I wanted to integrate him more into the world of Superman and Batman. And if you want to be like, if you want a brutal oversimplification of the DC universe, you can sort of split characters into these are Superman characters and these are Batman characters. And I think Jefferson goes into the Superman character bucket. Not from his power set, but just his point of view. He is more sunlight than moonlight, I think. And it seemed like Metropolis would be a good way to anchor him into that energy, so that when he came into Gotham, he is not a Gothamite-like person, but, you know, he's coming from the shinier, brighter city into the darker, more foreboding city. Not that I have anything against Cleveland at all, and we'll probably dig into his origins, you know, there at some point in the narrative, as the narrative goes forward. Here he's talking to, you know, as a person from a school. I used to teach. I wasn't like a, you know, like a tenured teacher or anything like that, but I was a substitute teacher because you could do that without having to get certified back in the day. And I, you know, education is really important to me. I mean, I wouldn't be here where I am right now if I didn't have an education. So I like to honor, you know, the work that teachers do because it's very important. You know, those are the times in our lives when we form our senses of self, when we start thinking about our possibility. And it's really important, I think, to remember the hard work of that job. I think it's great that Jefferson's a school teacher because we need more school teacher heroes. School teachers are heroes anyway, so it's good to see them you know, doing that role in a comic book. And after I've said all that, now we're getting ready to do something terrible to Tina here at the bottom of the page. Which I suppose is like a Brian Hill, you know, kind of trademark. You know, I always tend to kick characters down the stairs and watch them have to climb up to the top again. I guess that's mainly because I believe in adversity and stories about adversity, and I'm more interested in adversity than I am victory some of the time. I guess growing up, I learned more from the adversity in a story than the victory of a story. So characters that win all the time and kind of walk between the raindrops of consequence, I've never really been into that because it didn't feel real for me. I mean, I certainly didn't win all the time, and I needed to read stories that helped me deal with failure and deal with loss and those things. So that's the kind of work that I do is do those kinds of moments and really play the consequence of them. You know? So moving on from 18 to page 19, here we go to Caught Him with Ra's al Ghul and Lady Shiva. And I'm really enjoying writing both of these characters. Ra's al Ghul has always been one of my favorite characters. I remember when I was a kid and I would read the TV Guide because back in the day there was something called TV Guide and it would tell you what was coming on. And I would read the synopses of what the Batman the Animated Series episodes would be. And if there was a Ra's al Ghul episode coming up, then I would make sure I set my VCR and I would tape it and watch it because the character never got a lot of treatment outside of the comics. And even within the comics, he would go away for long periods of time. And I just thought he was a fascinating guy. You know, subsequently with Batman Begins, you know, and the Christopher Nolan work, we got a lot of Ra's al Ghul, but not even that wasn't the comic book Ra's al Ghul. You know, Nolan's world was more grounded, so his immortality was kind of like a sleight of hand more than an actual immortality. Like, there is no Lazarus pit in the world of Nolan's Batman, at least none that we can see. But the kind of operatic, immortal, sorcerer, you know, eco, not really terrorist, but extremist that Ra's al Ghul is, but also like combined with almost like Marcus Aurelius, you know, he's got these meditations. And it's like the acquired wisdom that he's built over all of his time has led him to a different truth, a truth that lives outside of our ethics. And that's a fascinating thing to write because he does have his own system of ethics. It's just outside of our own. But for him, you know, we're all very temporary because time is different for a man. It doesn't have to fear the advance of time. You know, not that he is permanently immortal, but he is certainly removed from the relationship that, you know, you or I may have with death. And I wonder if we live longer, what would we learn about the world? How would that change our view of the world? Right? Would we lose our current sense of ethics and gain a more brutal sense of ethics? You look like the Old Testament God, and you know that seems like a God that if a man were to do the things that the Old Testament God does, we would call him, you know, like a tyrant. Right. And that's always been an interesting, I don't know if it's a contradiction, but a complication, you know, with deity and religion and all that. And so, you know, Raish kind of embodies that, those sorts of things. And Shiva, I've always been just a fan of the character, you know. I'm a bad martial artist, but a long-time martial artist. And, you know, the discipline that it takes to get to Shiva's level, you know, the innate ability combined with that discipline, I think is really fascinating. I mean, she's a woman that's turned herself into a weapon. But she's done it in the conscientious way. She's not a victim of her circumstances. She has just molded herself in a certain way. I mean, she's somewhat similar to Batman, you know, in that way. You know, I always thought that Shiva and Batman have a lot of potential, you know, to, when they're in the same story, especially with Cassandra Cain being almost shared between them. And I love the way that Dexter draws Ra's al Ghul here. And, you know, the way Veronica does colors is really fantastic. And, you know, there's a sexiness to it. And I think that's cool. You know, I like to have characters that are just a little more stylish than we are in the real world. You know, to be able to dive into the fantasy of those things. But he also, you know, kind of renders Shiva, especially, you know, she's attractive, but it's very functional. You know, you can tell that there's a muscle tone there, and you know, it's not just, you know, sexiness and proportions and the rest of it. It's almost like an athlete, you know, like the kind of physical charisma that you know, an Olympian has, where you just can tell that they've just shaped and molded their body, you know, according to function. And I think that's a cool thing. And so, you know, they're having a conversation about extremity and what Raish might be doing, what he may do in the future. And perhaps we're setting up that, you know, there might be a difference in perspective between Raish and Lady Shiva. We'll have to see how that one plays itself out. And then finally, we have this big splash page. And I'm not always the splash page cliffhanger at the end of the issue guy, but I felt like here we kind of needed it. Because we're in a propulsion kind of period of the story now. We need to really like push through these issues and, you know, get to these conflicts and all of that. And so I wanted to end this on kind of like a big thing. You know, Ra's al Ghul is always living with his thumb on the scale. And any calm you have is a calm before the storm. And the next, you know, few issues will be a series of storms, really. And so here we are. Rules are off the table. End of issue 8. So, yeah, that's my walkthrough of Batman and the Outsiders, number 8. My name is Brian Hill. I'm the writer of this book. Dexter Soy is the artist of this book. Veronica Gandini does the colors. Clayton Cowles is the letterer, and Tyler Kirkham and Ney Rufino have done the main cover. And I'm really happy to be a part of this and to collaborate with all these great people. And I'm having a blast writing this book, and I hope you're having a blast reading it. So thank you.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Mastered by Anna Rubinova. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcast.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Forever Dog Team and liking our page on Facebook.